A really good starting point is perhaps actually the very beginning of the play. The play was a big success. Bartley was a big success in 1971, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And it kind of made Simon Gray's name. I think it's pretty much suggested. I mean, it was a kind of first breakthrough hit for him.
Yeah.
And to some extent, because of the performance that Alan Bates gave as Bartley in the film that subsequently followed, Pinter directed, it became this sort of kind of landmark play, but in some ways perhaps quite difficult to revive.
And that's what baffled me when I read it, because I think it became, as you say, it gained a sort of iconic status in certain circles. And I think both Simon Gray and indeed Harold Pinter, who directed it, were so close to Alan Bates. In fact, as we know, Alan Bates did lots of his work, that they kind of felt that it was untouchable to some respects. But when I read it fairly recently, it must have been just under 2 years ago when I read it again, and I was amazed that it hadn't been given a major London revival, because it feels to me, along with Quatermain's Terms, perhaps his best work, and hopefully audiences will feel it's as fresh as ever, because it's certainly coming across that way.
I suppose one of the, is it a dilemma, perhaps it's just a practical decision that has to be taken about the play, is it because it's so kind of embedded in perhaps the university culture of that time,
yeah,
because Gray himself was really steeped in that world of,
yeah,
of lecturing and teaching, do you absolutely faithfully honour that, or are there things you have to do to,
yes,
make it seem less of a period?
No, I think we have faithfully honoured it, and interestingly, I don't think it's at all an issue or a problem. I think once one accepts the context straight away, and what's paramount in the play is a story of loneliness, despair, and power relations within an institution like London University. So, in which case, in that sense, it kind of steps out of its context very, very quickly for an audience, I think.
Mm-hmm. I mean, do you think there's I mean, comedy is the thing that one thing that dates fastest, usually, isn't it? I mean, we look back on,
yeah,
equivalent era comedy, perhaps even the Pythons at that point.
Yeah.
Some of it has lasted, some of it hasn't.
Yeah.
I suppose 40 years on, is this as much an experiment as, in a sense, a foregone conclusion that audiences will find it equivalently funny to the audience?
I hope so. I mean, I it's one of the few plays I laughed out loud when reading, and I don't think, I mean, obviously pop if you like populist comedy, be it The Young Ones or Monty Python or any contemporary program moves with the times in that sense, but I think because this play comes very much from a stylist's literary genre, it strikes me, having just done An Ideal Husband, it's in the tradition of Oscar Wilde. So it sets its own agenda, really. One may not like that agenda, but within that, it's hilarious, I think.
Yes. I suppose, can you identify, or maybe that's partly what's interesting about the play, is that it wasn't critically necessarily embraced first time round, but audiences liked it, and Bartley himself, as a character, as an idea, became almost part of perhaps 70s parlance in a way, that people had this idea of who Bartley was, this sort of slightly disintegrating but waspishly amusing academic, and
yeah,
it seemed to stick almost as a kind of type or an archetype.
Yes.
I don't know, is it
I suppose what sticks for me about the role is the relentless drive to energetic drive to self-destruction. That's what really comes across in the play, and that's where the character's genius lies, and it's written in such a way that you can't help but be want him to stop at the same time you want him to go on, and you kind of love him and hate him for it. My worry before I started rehearsals was I felt it was crucial to make sure the character is sympathetic, because there's so much cruelty, cruel wit, cruel destruction of relationships through the course of it, that I thought this could be alienating, and you just think, God, what a nasty piece of work. But actually, when you find the heart of it, the heart of his loneliness and despair, there's a cumulative effect with it that hopefully, I think, becomes very moving.
Mm. Well, of course, it was written about in its New York Guys by Gray himself, rather beautifully, eloquently, wittily, and wistfully, I think, seeing the Nathan Lane production on Broadway, where I think Gray's name was kind of eliminated from the lights outside the theatre and given, and Lane's was given kind of full prominence. I mean, I suppose that suggests, with an actor of that calibre, a certain charisma is required, a certain ingrained likability. And I guess, without wanting to put words in your mouth, that must be partly why Dominic West is taking this role.
I think that's true. I didn't see the New York production. Nathan Lane is a great charismatic character actor. I was surprised by the casting, insofar as this is a very English play, and it's very important that whoever plays the role understands that Britishness. And also has a charismatic appeal, but doesn't play up, doesn't mug the humour. I mean, the humour has to be intrinsic to the character's wit, and it's a very, very English style. It doesn't strike me as something that would transfer to American culture that easily, to be honest. Mm. Having not seen it, I can't comment on the production, but that's my instinct.
Yeah.
I think Dominic was, in a way, it sounds like a cliche to say born to play it, but you know, he's Eton educated Trinity before drama school and actor, and he really understands the academic life. He has, as well as being very charismatic and having a driving leading actor's energy, he also understands the self-destructive anarchic nature of the character, the subversive character. It's very important that whoever plays the role has that dark, that wickedness in them, which Dominic has, in the best sense of the word.
I mean, I don't know whether you've seen particular performances of his that lend you to kind of reach that conclusion. I mean, he's not particularly well known for comedy, is he, Dominic West? Clearly, most of the time that he's spent in the public eye has actually, to some degree, been spent in an incredibly well-acclaimed American drama series. So
that's true. What people forget, or perhaps haven't seen in him, is that actually his forte is doing very powerful, very extreme character roles. I saw him in Carol Churchill's Cloud Nine at the Old Vic, I remember, and he was hilarious. And he can go from tough, macho, hot, you know, tough macho hunk to camp effete queen within a matter of seconds, and that's what he does brilliantly, and it's just what the role needs, you know.
I mean, I wonder whether it's something that you as a director can, I don't know, improve, change, ameliorate in performance, those kind of comic subtleties, whether you are pretty much wholly reliant on that actor. I mean, comic timing and the finesse of that is difficult, isn't it?
One needs to cast a play, so what, I don't know, 50% of it is in the casting or more, I'd say, of a production success, and one needs to know you've got the right actor for the role.
Yeah.
Having said that, the pitch and the balance between self-destructive, maudlin, drunkenness, sentimentality, which I've tried to expunge as much as possible from the play, and camp, it's a dangerous balance to strike, and one has to make sure that when you're playing with a play that's in lots of ways about someone with a repressed sexuality, repressed homosexuality in this case, in fact it's not even clear whether it's repressed or latent, whether he's articulated it to himself or not, one has to be very careful to striking the balance between the maleness of the play, in a macho sense, and the moments when he goes into camp self-consciously to torment his friend and colleague Joey, and that was an interesting balance to achieve through rehearsals.
It certainly is. I mean, without wishing to be in any way disparaging of the Bates performance on screen, which is obviously my only reference point in that case, I think because of the times in which it was produced, if nothing else, you know, the way accents of a certain class then sounded as they would distinctly do differently now, there is a quality perhaps of sort of pertness, priggishness perhaps, that creeps in to that performance in that particular film, which is quite alienating, I suppose. Would,
I think
would
that's
look
true.
Can't really be...
I think it's interesting when one watches acting that's 40 years old on screen or of a stage play, because acting, as we know, is so much defined by the political culture where the theatre's happening. It struck, I mean, this is digressing slightly, but I remember going to Berlin just after a few years after the Berlin Wall came down to see shows there, and there was a, it struck me how acting style is so formed by political culture, that there was a mix of actors trained in the East and actors trained in the West in a play. It was actually at the Deutsches Theater, it was a Chekhov, and the East actors from the East were presenting the play in a very understated, clinical style, and the actors from the West were emoting a la Albert Finney all over the place. And it really hit home that the acting style moves with the times. And this play, watching the Alan Bates performance in 1970, obviously we haven't had the kind of political convulsions that Berlin has been through, but nevertheless, that there's a style which now to us seems quite mannered, I think, in lots of ways, and self-conscious, which now would be very alienating indeed if we saw that on stage, I think.
So really what one's able to say about it is that while, from your point of view, the comedy itself has been undimmed by time, what's really crucial about a revival now is that it creates a kind of modern accent on that comedy.
Yes.
And it's not seen to be too, you know, that sense of what might seem now remote about simple playing styles is kind of scraped away, so that you get something that feels as it should have done then.
I think that's absolutely right, and I think it's a case of finding the kind of raw heart of the play, and in one sense a modern acting presentation takes care of itself, because we are what we are, but I was aware of that when we were doing it.
So what can one say about Bartley Gray and this, what you talk about as latent homosexuality? I mean, he's quite coy and clever about it in The Last Cigarette. He talks about the kind of man he was then, the kind of man who wrote it. I think he, in an interview on the DVD for the film, really does express the fact that it came from him, it came from part of his life, a time of his life, when he was not particularly happily married, it seems, had children. Was it a kind of crossroads, perhaps? I don't know to what extent he then confronted something about himself, but have you discovered things about that relationship in terms of the character and him and what's going on? Because it's a lot.
I know.
One could tiptoe around it. It almost...
You can. On the one hand, it's dangerous to get into biographical detail because the play is the play. I really believe that. And, you know, I do respect writers when they say it has nothing to do with me. Yes, of course, I can only write what I know and what I am, ultimately. But one has to divorce that, I think, from the person who wrote it, that you know, it stands on its own. I mean, all I know is that, I mean, the conflicts, I can go into detail about the conflicts that go through the leading character in the play, whether or not they were Simon Gray's conflicts, who knows?
No. I mean, I suppose is it, I mean, I'm basically asking questions because I think there is a layer of respectful distance about this sort that people adopt towards Gray, but he does seem to have basically suggested that there were periods in his early youth where he had a homosexual phase or had homosexual relations, and then there were men that he felt passionately about, and he sort of acknowledges that without really expanding on that in the various diaries. And I suppose it feels as though this play couldn't have been written without somebody at some level understanding that at the core of this play there's a male friendship, and one side of this male friendship is very, very reluctant to watch the other side, who is avowedly, or at least partly openly, homosexual, go off with another man. And that's there's all kinds of obvious affinities with any friendship, I think, particularly male friendship, of seeing somebody else, somebody you're very close to, sort of become partnered to some other, whether male or female.
Indeed.
But
we discussed a lot about whether Jerry and Butler's relationship had ever been consummated sexually. We decided it hadn't, probably. And that it hasn't openly been talked about. We looked into the 70s context for homosexuality, and it's people really found it very, very difficult to speak about. I know, there are gay friends I know who found it difficult now to tell their parents that they were gay, but in the 70s it really was very difficult to be open about it. And I think so that coded language, you know, when one thinks of the other academic in the play, Edna, whether she knows they're gay, she probably does, but she would never have mentioned it and never mentions it in the play. And there are one or two nice moments in the play where she asks them if they're, you know, she says, "Oh, I see you're back together again," to Joey and Batley, when they say they're living together again. She doesn't go further than that, but you can tell there's something going through her mind.
So at one level, actually, the play is all about people sort of tacitly acknowledging that the other knows what the situation is without ever spelling it out.
That's absolutely right.
And half
so,
assuming and half, you know, ignoring.
That's right. I mean, if you read, there's a book by Brian McGee written in the 70s about homosexuality, written really to as a liberal exploration of to tell the general public to be reassured that, you know, it's not a crime and it's not unnatural. But even within that, he talks about, you know, people being different and it being an aberration, and how you can go for all sorts of aversion therapies to be cured. They still talk about being cured. This is written in 1972, this book.
I mean, it'd be interesting to know what Dominic West's own encounters with English academia were. What's fascinating about that culture, that sort of quite effete, sarcastic, there's a kind of, I don't know, there are certain recognisable traits one sees in that one sees in Bartley and can see in, you know, unnamed real life people. But it seems as though that it kind of created a front or a mask through which you could or could not be homosexual. I mean, that in a weird way, that the academic culture lends itself or lent itself with its affectations and its allusions to, you know, literature, a kind of quality of code, a quality of coded behaviour.
That's right. I mean, the two academics I talked to talked about a man who was in the English department who was gay but kept it secret from the world at large, except he told his closest colleagues that he was gay, but very rarely brought his partner into the public world, you know. But they all knew, but they didn't really talk about it.
Yeah. And is there any distinct difference in the way that Bartley treats his female students to his male students? I don't know whether I mean, he's pretty difficult with all of them, isn't
he? He's pretty misogynistic with the women in the play, although having said that, there's a rather moving scene with Edna at the end where I think he identifies with her loneliness, and he suddenly sees himself as, if you like, the male equivalent of a spinster.
Edna being, we should explain, the kind of fellow academic.
Edna being a fellow academic who is isolated, lives for her work, and seems to have had a lesbian relationship while she was writing a book on Byron 20 years earlier, to the play being written, which went wrong when her friend Ursula got married during Chapter 6, she says.
Is it... the case, Victoria Gray denies actually that she really ever said that it was the most misogynist play she'd ever seen, and I suppose one does grope around looking through the play thinking, well, apart from being disparaging towards women, what's outright misogynist about it?
I don't think it is misogynist. I think what the play clearly is, that obviously there's more interest in the men in the play, but I've made sure that we've given the scenes with Edna, and particularly with Anne, the wife, the estranged wife of Batley, an emotional weight and a kind of a devastating weight and a dignity that counterbalances any feeling that it might be misogynistic.
And can you just recap on your own encounters with Gray, either in terms of your professional working life and inspirations, and you've stated that, you know, you did have very preliminary contact with Gray.
I did. I mean, I was always very fond of his writing. I'm fond of many of his plays and diaries, and I sort of came to him via Harold Pinter, who I was a big fan of and whose play, The Birthday Party, I directed. And Harold Pinter sometimes spoke about Simon, so it was there was a sort of indirect contact going on. Unfortunately, I did only have the one meeting with him,
And this was to outline the idea
it was
of
to talk
revival.
About the revival, to talk about, yes, the play, and I asked him questions about the play, and we chatted a lot about French literature, French novels, which he was at the time passionate about.
And was he keen about the idea of Butler coming back?
Very much so, yeah. He was thrilled about it, actually. Mm. And felt it was time to have it re-examined, I think. That's what's exciting about this. Hopefully, both the critical fraternity and the public at large will see that it's worthy of re-examination, because it's so far we've only done three run-throughs, but the it's cumulatively moving, the play, I think.
It's interesting, isn't it, because Grey is that hallowed beast of British theatre, in the sense that he did achieve commercial success with quite a number of his plays.
Yes.
And I wonder what his attitude might have been if he expressed it at all about being revived in the West End, because of course there were various issues about plays that didn't get perhaps the West End transfers or the West End look-ins they deserved. But at the same time, the culture has changed so much that it's almost, where does Grey fit? You know, should he be revived rather more constantly in the subsidised repertoire, or does he actually in some ways belong finally to that particular West End audience?
Yes.
And
I think, you know, I think this play in particular, and perhaps Quatermain's Terms, absolutely merits a platform at the National Theatre. I cannot for the life of me see why the National haven't revived any of his plays. I think Close of Play was the last one they did, I believe. When Peter Hall was running the National, I think. That's a long time out of subsidised theatre. It's extraordinary, really.
Mm. I mean, is it because he's seen to be too entertaining for his own good, do you think? I mean, that he's almost damned for giving audiences what they do want, which is a bit of
it's possible. Who knows? I mean, what one doesn't really understand, sometimes it's difficult to understand changes in fashion. Look what's happened to Terence Rattigan, you know, frowned upon by the critics for ages, and then suddenly, you know, and I know, I can't remember the name of the play that was done at the National recently.
After the Dance
is a wonderful play, but it took years for institutions like the National to be persuaded to do it. And look, you know, it's rightly acclaimed. It's a great play, I think.
And that's the curse of the well-made play, perhaps. The plays were,
yes,
all about,
sense that
in
it's
the 70s,
not challenging
particularly
enough. It's a bit stuffy. It doesn't quite hit the zeitgeist in the way that one would want a play to do, but you know, things change fast, and last year's stuffy play becomes this year's zeitgeist play.
Yeah, I mean, it is interesting that at the time that Grey was committing you know, these plays to paper and production, the, you know, that experimental wave of From the Fringe, those particular sexual mores that the repression in Butler sort of identifies as being perhaps on the cusp, perhaps,
yeah,
forever locked in the British psyche. You know, you think Grey sort of turned its back on perhaps that route towards a slightly less conventional form. I mean, he kept going along recognisable tracks, I suppose, but that maybe to then overlook some of the subversion and the wit and the invention in those plays, Butler particularly, perhaps. You know,
I think so, because some of this feels outrageous. The homophobic attacks on Reg that Butler makes are, you know, they leave you aghast, even in a postmodern world where gay men can sit and laugh at, you know, being called fairy or poof or whatever happens in the play. It still makes you gasp watching it.
I mean, do you think that's, as with Rattigan, really what Grey's writing about in this play, maybe in others as well? It's hard to create a great overview because his work is quite varied, but that he does write about that tortured English middle-class heart.
Yes.
Know?
And the point at which a boundary might be crossed or reached, both emotionally and psychologically, really.
Mm. It has, I suppose, some affinities with Look Back in Anger, in the sense that you have a very strong, very dominant male voice, don't you, at the centre of it.
Yeah.
And other characters sort of come into its orbit,
yeah,
and get snapped at. I mean, I don't know whether there are other plays like it, because in some ways it does seem quite a lone beast in the modern canon, doesn't it? I mean, it's not, there aren't that many plays.
No, there aren't. There's lots of novels. You can think, oh, Philip Roth, or, you know, where there is male menopausal character going towards self-destruction and agonising about sexuality, marriage. But not that many in the world of drama, I don't think. You're right.
And can you divulge any particular stipulations that Gray gave about the piece that he wanted to see in it or felt could be done with it? I don't know whether there was any advice to the players, as it were, from Gray's, in even in that early meeting with you.
We didn't get that far, really. Yeah. We did have general chats about the nature of truth in comedy. That comedy is only funny if you stick strictly to the truth and don't go for any self-conscious comic business. Which, I mean, that sounds very a cliche, a very basic directing note. But you know, it's that holds true for particularly plays like Aitborn, for example, where Aitborn can become a very, very serious and interesting writer if one presents it with a truthful ensemble playing, rather than playing up to comic West End business, if you like, in the kind of cliched sense.
Yes, you don't want to have them rolling in the arts because they'll be kind of
exactly
forgetting the play.
Yeah,
and I don't know whether you can give, given that we have a bit more time, possibly a few more minutes. Can you sort of give a kind of potted account of how you come to be here, in a sense? I mean, your own first steps into directing, how far back were they? What was the I'm trying to work out whether there's almost an affinity in era. There can't be, can there? Early 70s?
No, I didn't 70s. Start directing till the mid-80s.
Mid-80s, right.
When I joined the Royal Court.
Yeah.
But came into contact with a mixture of very badly made plays and well-made plays when I was there. And I've always had a love for working with writers who are still around. Unfortunately, Simon's not.
Mm.
But I suppose, you know, I've gone on very varied paths, really, from new plays through to classic, through to quite a bit of American drama, particularly Mamet and Arthur Miller.
Mm. I mean, do you think there is a curse of theatrical novelty chasing, I suppose, that we, you know, that there is a fear of doing work that's, to some extent, might seem old-fashioned? I mean,
yeah, I mean, that's always been the case, and certain production styles have been hailed over the last 20 years that, you know, there's always a kind of new thing on the block attitude. But I still think there has always been a place for the sort of aesthetic principles and theories I learnt at the Royal Court, really, which is about respect for text and for acting, detailed approaches to acting. And respect for the writer in the sense of actually properly finding the true voice of a play in a detailed fashion. I don't think that will go out of fashion in one sense, although other things will come in and out around it.